Hello and welcome to another episode of Gemstone Mine. I'm John.
I'm Alex.
And I'm Jake.
And today we've got another lesson from CEDH. And this time we're going to be asking the question, and then hopefully trying to answer the question, what makes a good commander? CEDH is a metagame within the commander format that sits at one extreme, with highly consistent, highly efficient decks. But not all cards are equally powerful in all formats, or even in all metagames. But there are still lessons to be learned from how people are brewing with the most powerful cards available in Magic. Before we get to that, though, you know where we gotta start. We gotta talk about some news. So, Jake, you mentioned that recently there had been an update to the CEDH decklist database.
Yeah, the CEDH decklist database does periodic updates where they have their reviewers go over decks that have been submitted. And once they have been reviewed, they'll add them all in a big batch. And this was one of those particularly large batches. So there's a lot of new entries in the main page, but they also have a Brewer's Corner, which is in a drop-down menu that you can access. They featured a lot of new decks that were brewed with recent commanders or just like weird tech from old commanders, that kind of stuff. So if you want to get a little more variety and spice in your CEDH games, you can check out some of those Brewer Corner decks and take a gander at what they've got going on there.
Or if you're just looking for some inspiration to find new ideas to bring to other tables, there's going to be some wacky stuff over there. I am particularly interested to see what more technology comes out with Malcolm, Keen-Eyed Navigator. It's just a commander I really, really enjoy.
Yeah, and especially if you are interested in commanders that have come out in a very recent set, this would be a good place to look for it, because they do have a set of requirements that decks have to have been playtested X amount of times and so on. So if it's a brand new commander, it obviously hasn't been tested that much, so you'll see a lot of stuff here.
Absolutely, and the good hits keep on rolling. Moxfield is apparently getting collection management, as Jake, you found out with a Discord message. For anybody who is currently trying to store their collections as a single deck, please stop doing this, because it's going to be invalidated really soon, because I'm working on collection management as we speak.
Yep, apparently that was a thing some people were doing, which, I mean, clever idea, but Harry said, hey, don't do that, because you're going to have to do it again. So, collection management, Moxfield, that'll be cool.
It will be. Something that I have been looking forward to. It has been what has kept me very happily at Architect for most of my brewing, and the fact that I can never remember how cards are spelled correctly. So, yeah, Architect's search engine is still a little bit better for me, but I'm glad to see this feature coming to Moxfield.
Yeah, I've tried a lot of different collection management services in the past, and they all had things that just I did not like, so I wound up just making a spreadsheet, and then I quit updating that like 2.5 years ago, so it's completely useless, and I honestly don't know where my cards are anymore. So, hey, we'll see if this one works any better.
Womp womp. Well, Alex, we've got some news on the Magic front as well. We've got spoilers from not one, but two sets, and why don't we take these in chronological order, unlike Wizards of the Coast, and talk about maybe some cards from Time Spiral Remastered first. You mentioned there's some potentially good reprints in there.
There are. Time Spiral Remaster is coming to us as one of the supplement sets, not standard legal, but it brings a lot in terms of both CEDH staples that exist and normal EDH staples that exist that hopefully lower the price on some of the existing ones, making it more accessible. Things like Pack of Negation, older frame artwork for Laboratory Maniac and Remand is pretty neat. It'll make it so a lot of older cards are easier to come by. The one that pops out to me immediately, just because it took me a while to get one, is actually Delay, of all things, being reprinted with new art as an uncommon.
I wound up getting my Delay out of Mystery Boosters because it was on that foil retail exclusive sheet, and it wound up being the same price as the regular Delay, so I got a shiny Delay for my Yuriko CEDH deck. But I'm happy to see it getting reprinted as well.
And we got a downshifted Aven Mind Sensor as well.
Back to Uncommon, because I think Aven Mind Sensor was Uncommon in Future Sight originally. And then we also have some news with the next proper standard legal set, Strixhaven, which is going to be the set which, similar to Ikoria last year, is going to come with the cycle of 5 commander decks.
Yep.
Yep. That's all we know.
So they are the enemy color pairs in this set. And after some poking, Mark Rosewater has mentioned that it's going to be focused on where the colors clash, not where they overlap. So we should see some fresh takes on color pairs that we've already seen in a couple other sets. So this will be kind of neat.
Yeah, famously, we're going to be basically stuck comparing these wizarding school houses to essentially Ravnica guilds. Like, we have the Boros Guild, we have the Boros Lore Weaver, whatever.
Lorehold House,
excuse me. And they're going to have a hard time shaking off the dust that is the Boros Legion. It'll be really interesting to see what they wind up doing with this. We've seen a cycle of commands so far, similar to Atarka's command, Kolaghan's command from Dragons of Tarkir, except it's the two enemy colors that are forming these commands with multiple options. I think it's pick two out of a list of four.
That's correct.
Okay, and we're going to see kind of, hopefully, more coming out of the set that details what's going to be going on in these houses and how these enemy color pairs are going to be clashing, not where they are, I guess, overlapping.
Yeah, and I'm not going to lie, when it was spoiled, my first, you know, everyone's first thought was Harry Potter, and I'm just like, I really hope, I don't know how they're going to do this. Now seeing the artwork and design for them, it's like, oh, these are just guilds from Ravnica, essentially, just reskinned for Strixhaven.
It definitely does not feel like a Harry Potter thing. I know that's where a lot of the community went when they're like, oh, magic schools, but, I mean, magic school is a very wide range of representation in various bits of movies and books and everything, like Discworld, and I know The Witcher has magic colleges, and I mean the Tolarian Academy is right there in magic. I do like how it looks like the different, I don't know, colleges? Yeah, the different colleges are all focusing on like real world subjects. So like the red white are the historians, the blue red are the theater kids, the green blue are the math majors. The math magicians, that's kind of neat.
Math magicians.
White, black, or like first. Beat poets with battle poetry, something. They're like mean bards.
I never would have expected black, white to be writing diss tracks.
And then green, black are the goth bio majors. All right, sure. I'm interested to see how this goes.
This is magic meets young adult fantasy.
Hasn't it always been, though?
I don't know. I will say Lorehold Command does look like it could be right out of Ravnica. There's a Loxodon and they're shooting lightning. So.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, pivoting from Wizards of the Coast and their recent previews, there have been some really great pushes for charity in the community recently. Jake, you and I saw recently that, as of the time of this recording, would have been last week, that the Mental Missteps and Rebel Sun had been raising charity with a stream they held on February 26th, to support an organization called RAIN.
Yeah, unfortunately, I missed this stream. I'm a little upset that I missed it. I just had other stuff going on and couldn't get there. So it's really cool that they were raising funds for RAIN. It's a nonprofit anti-sexual assault organization that does a lot of really good work out there. So anytime that gets support and people play Magic, I think that's a good overlap.
That is a very good overlap. And we were kind of cup runneth over, as last week, by the time of this coming out as well, the prof at Tolarian Community College was holding his own charity fundraiser to support Trans Lifeline. And I think the fundraiser was, I think, trying to auction off two boxes of Ultimate Masters or Double Masters?
Yeah, so initially it started off with prof saying there's two boxes of Double Masters. And if you donate $4 to this fund, you get an entry. So every $4 entry gives you another draw. And then people just started coming out of the woodwork to offer more prizes. As of the recording, there's stuff like a signed Library of Alexandria and multiple booster boxes and all kinds of ridiculous amounts of stuff. There's like a foil Gaia's Cradle and then people offering custom deck boxes. And it's just really cool to see the community come out so much to support this. And as of the time of recording, it's almost at $150,000 raised over
I will make sure that in the show notes, I will include the final value of it. And I will make sure that in the YouTube version of this episode, we're going to include the final value with links to the... If somehow you found us and don't know about Tolarian Community College, I will happily point you in their direction. Similarly for Mental Missteps and for Rebel Sun, I'll be happy to send more traffic their way with our tiny little soapbox that we stand upon.
Yeah, even if you miss the deadline for any of these fundraisers, you can still donate to these amazing causes. So do that if you can. And if you can't, do that.
All right. Now, Jake, normally this is the part of the episode where you have been sitting silent over the past few months, but in terms of games we played, you are here to tell us about a couple of CDH games you played.
Yeah, I finally dusted off my webcam and got everything set up and played a couple games of CEDH with, at my time, my only CEDH deck that I still had put together, Najeela. I did not win either of my two games, but I did manage to get a Jeweled Lotus turn one Najeela out. That was a pretty cool feeling until the next turn when somebody stole it with the Gilded Drake, and I was like, well, cool. Yep. And then I was kind of out of that game. I did, at one point, have Tainted Pact, Thassa's Oracle, and Pact of Negation sitting in my hand staring at a Rule of Law effect and feeling a little sad. But, you know, it happens.
Rule of Law is good.
Yep.
It is a very good card and a very good effect. Well, we had no other real exciting games in the past couple weeks. We have been doing some brewing with some new decks. Alex, why don't we start with the I guess we'll call it the nascent egg of a plan you have.
All right, so actually, in my mental headcanon, I call it a Tale of Two Elves. One of them is a Temur Value Elves, designed to kind of combo off with the board present, and the other one is an Abzan Value Elves, where I try to get as big a board presence as possible and then use board presence to win. That's all I got so far. I got colors and like four cards.
All right, keep us updated on where you're going to go with it. Jake, you are brewing another, or assembling another CDH deck?
Yeah, there's not much brewing here. I think I'm switching out two cards from the stock deck list, but I am putting together the Godo Helm deck, just because it's cool. It's a very aggressive type of deck that I don't know why I've taken so long to put together and try out, but I am looking forward to it, and I think it will play into our little CDH meta pretty well. So, hooray, Godo.
I never thought I would say it, but Jake now has two mono red decks.
This is true. I mean, it doesn't hurt that red has gotten a lot of support in the last year or so, and I think that red might be one of the stronger colors now, which is pretty cool.
It is extremely cool. And I'm going to be brewing with red and your other favorite color, Jake, with black, as I'm brewing the deck Cardor the Doom Scourge. This is the red-black uncommon Demon Berserker from Kaldheim. I got the fancy showcase treatment for it with the Viking art, and I am not sure exactly what direction the deck will wind up going. It is going to include mass reanimation, because when you mass reanimate a bunch of things, normally the downside is your opponents get the first use of those creatures. Well, if your commander re-enters the battlefield at the same time and effectively goads all of them, yes, they get the same first crack at all those creatures, but they're all going to be pointed away from you. So, yeah, I am looking forward to playing around with this one.
Yeah, I've seen some of the stuff you're doing with this deck and offered a couple suggestions, and I am looking forward to it. One cool little note is that Cardor has that effect that's like Goad, but it's so much better than Goad because it even applies to stuff that was not around, because Goad is actually hitting the creatures that are in play. Cardor's hitting the players, so
correct.
Anytime they get a creature after he's around, it's still goaded, so that's cool.
Exactly. It's super, super cool. Ah, well, speaking of super, super cool, we've talked about some of the decks and some of the concepts that we are brewing around with, and that makes a good time as ever for us to start talking about what is a commander.
Yeah, so this is like episode 19 in a commander podcast, and if you're listening to this, you obviously play the format, or you're lost. And asking what is a commander is kind of a stupid-sounding question, but before we completely dismiss it, I think it's worth looking into. So, in the game, a commander is a guaranteed card that you will always have in your opening hand and throughout the game. So you never have to hope to draw this or spend any resources to tutor for it out of your deck.
Anymore, at least. Once upon a time, before rules changes, there were effects that could, in fact, shuffle your commander into your deck, and then you would actually have to tutor for them and or hope to draw them. So,
yes, that but is those, bygone
the dark
era.
Ages. the Dark Ages.
This is absolutely true, but yeah, the best way to think of it is that it is essentially an 8-card or 9-card hand that we see in decks that are using partners. And we saw just how game-warping it can be in 60-4 formats when they just had access to a companion with a significant deck-building restriction. So I don't think it's a stretch to say that having that extra card in your hand, or in the command zone in this case, really does heavily inform our format.
Yeah, the companions are a good thing to look at. They completely warped every single format they were legal in, to the point that the rules for them got rewritten. So just think about how strong of an effect that is, and especially the consistency. In a 60-card format where you have four copies of each card, you already have more consistency. In a 100-card singleton format, being able to guarantee a specific card is of tremendous value. So you would like to find some way to make sure that it has a solid, notable impact in your deck building. One way of taking this into account is looking at the mana cost of your commander. If you have like a really cheap commander, you can skew your deck building toward fast mana that will let you get them out on turn one or two. Like if you have a commander with a converted mana cost of three, or I guess a mana value of three.
That's going to be so hard to switch to.
It really will. Doubly so because the abbreviation is MV, and I keep seeing that as motion value because I play a lot of Monster Hunter World, or Monster Hunter in general. So anyway, so if your commander costs three, that means having some turn one ramp can get you to a guaranteed turn two commander. So if you're playing Land of War Elves or any of those one cost dorks, that can ensure that you have three mana on turn two. If you have a like two cost commander like Hapatra, those mana dorks go down in value because they're not going to help you get that commander out any faster. Instead, stuff like Lotus Petal or Elvish Visionary, or not Elvish Visionary, Elvish, help me.
Spirit Guide.
Yes, Elvish Spirit Guide become a lot more important to get it out that first turn.
And then you can kind of carry that forward as well. Once you start looking beyond the three CMC, once you start looking beyond the three mana value commanders, and you start looking at higher mana value commanders, such as in right now CEDH, we see a lot of five CM, a lot of five mana value commanders running around in the form of the very powerful and increasingly popular Krom and Tevish Zot lists that are out there. Having access to ways to produce large amounts of colorless or generic mana, such as Grim Monolith or Mana Vault, to get that three in your commander's mana cost paid for, it can really speed things along. On the other hand, if you have mana values that are very heavy on a specific color, like Niv-Mizzet or Niv-Mizzet Perun, famously for that red, 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 blue, 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 those types of effects where you're only getting colorless mana are a lot less powerful.
The commander also helps constrain the color identity your deck is based off of. Imagine if Turgrid was black-blue, or Scorpion God was black-green-red.
I have both dreams of those, like that.
Yeah, like we've had that conversation when spoiled, like, man, Scorpion God would be great if it was Jund, or Turgrid is good, but imagine if it had blue.
God, I would be so thrilled. Oh my god.
No, for both of them, because it would just be phenomenal having both. I think that was intentionally left out.
Yes, and I think that this is one of the strongest points of Commander as a format, just having that restriction that if you choose this Commander with a particularly powerful effect, you have to then build within the constraints of that particular color identity, which is one of the things that we're going to talk about in a couple of moments when we talk about the common aspects of CEDH Commanders. Because we need to understand what these powerful things are being done in CEDH before we can bring it back to the rest of the tables.
So looking at a lot of the CEDH decks, like if you go to the decklist database and poke through there, you'll notice that the vast majority of the commanders can be sorted into a couple different categories. You'll have commanders that are synergy or combo pieces for the decks. These are commanders that make the cards within the deck a lot more efficient or more powerful or both. This could be from turning normally unplayed garbage cards into actual game-ending pieces to even just taking good cards and making them great. Another category would be value engines or just value commanders. These are commanders that are going to help you accrue more resources while playing, which will make your game plan more consistent or faster. This will be stuff that, you know, draws you cards or produces mana or any other way of getting value in this game. And then there's also kind of a wild card category I was thinking of, like a unique effect or color identity, anything where you are looking at aspects of the commander that don't neatly fall into synergy or value. So if we're talking about these aspects of commanders, like synergy pieces, they are going to lean heavily on the fact that your commander is always available, and these are often parts of multi-piece combos in your deck. So if you have a two-card combo and part A is your commander, you can just focus your entire deck on getting part B. So either multiple copies of a part B or part B and its tutors, and you can just ensure that you will always have access to one half of your combo.
And that is the correct. That is the goal of your Nugeta deck, right? It is a and B kind of scenario where your commander is part A and the other half is in your deck. Actually, it's just ramping up your commander, right?
Yeah.
Go ahead, Jake. Explain this one in detail, because this is a really good example where it is essentially a one-card combo.
Yeah. So shorthand and combo-based commander decks usually refer to them as like an N-card combo, where N is how many cards you need. So something like Dramatic Reversal and Isochron Scepter is a two-card combo. Often, if one of those cards is your commander, they kind of discount it and don't count it into the numbers just because it's assumed that you always have access to it. So for this particular deck, it's Godo Bandit Warlord plus Helm of the Hosts. And when you get both of these pieces out, you'll have an infinite number of Godos and an infinite number of attack steps, and you can usually win from that. But the thing is, Godo himself tutors for the other piece. So it's kind of a zero card combo, which is incredibly unique to Commander. So all you have to do is have enough mana. You cast Godo, and then he gets the helm, and then you put the helm on Godo, and you're good. There's some other decks that really fall into this synergy piece, like Heliod Suncrowned, directly combos with either Triskelion or Walking Ballista. And there are a wide variety of other examples, like the Food Chain Commanders. A lot of those are more of an outlet than a direct combo piece, so you'll get your infinite Food Chain mana and then use Ukima, cast it multiple times to kill the table, or the First Sliver, cast it multiple times to cast your deck.
And on the opposite spectrum of synergy, you've got the value engine pieces, and this is where me personally as a player is I like to live, because value and effects and triggers are what I like. These are commanders that, by their very nature, serve as resource engines, either cards, mana, or something else. More commonly seen in the partners that fill these niches. Timnas, Thrasio, Chrom, etc. all have ways of drawing cards based on creatures, spare mana, or simply your opponent's casting spells. Other aspects provide large boosts of mana to vault ahead when you'd normally be with a typical collection of dorks, rocks, rituals, like Monogreen Savala, Kinnan, or Kaikar. And there are a handful of miscellaneous value engines as well, like Yidris with Cascade, Paco and Jalova with Pseudo Cardra from the whole table, and effects like that.
And oftentimes you're looking at these value engine type commanders when you don't have a particularly commander-centric combo to build around in CDH. For example, Timna's not going to go fetch you Helm of the Hosts and win on the spot with it. Timna's not going to be able to go infinite with Food Chain, by herself anyway. But she is going to draw you the cards you need to be able to assemble the other parts of the game-winning combo that most CEDH decks are looking to end the game with.
And they are powerful effects. The joke of it blocks Timna, while something that's recurring on the show, has merit. The concept of, oh, it blocks Timna is because of how relevant Timna is in the meta with simply having, I attack with creatures. You dealt damage, great, I'm going to draw cards. It is win-win, everything comes up Milhouse.
And usually if you hear somebody referring to a good stuff deck, it's a pile of just strong cards, and it's often helmed by one of these value engine style commanders, where you're just trying to rely on the overall strength of good cards in your deck plus a good card in your command zone.
And then one of the artifacts from the bygone era of CEDH was what Jake has kind of termed the unique effects, but I think is probably most properly boiled down to color identity. We identified early on that color identity is one of the defining features of Commander in general. Essentially, you are restricted to only using colors that are included on your Commander's physical card. That is your color identity. That's what makes this format so interesting. But what if you want to play a five-color Herbitruid deck? At that point, it doesn't really matter which legend is in your command zone. Your entire deck is there to play Hermitruid, get to your next turn, or give it haste, and tap Hermitruid, and put your library into your graveyard, and win the game on the spot. This is kind of a historical deck category at this point, but it points to the fact that once you have five colors represented in your command zone, in CEDH, there is essentially no real cost to doing so. Four-color commanders, like the partners, have gone a long way to opening up very broad color identities with very little in the way of cost.
And now that Kenrith the King Returned is a card, all these other five-mana legendaries from days gone by really have no purpose helming a deck anymore unless you're building around them.
Yeah, when I was putting all this together, my idea was to try to come up with the different categories. There's synergy, value, and then kind of like a wild card effect. But honestly, at this point in CEDH, almost all of the commanders are going to be a synergy piece or a value engine piece, or they'll be both. You can go into, because this is going to be more of like a sliding scale on each of these categories, you can definitely have commanders that are both really high synergy combo pieces and value engines. There's some examples like the Gitrog Monster, where it will get you so many card draws, it will fill up your graveyard. These are all resource generating aspects of the commander, but it's also a game-winning combo piece. Kes, Dissident Mage, is another example. Kes lets you cast cards out of your graveyard, so that's going to be generating extra value. But you can also just use Kes to recast your Demonic Consultation that went and fetched your Thassa's Oracle. So it is a game-winning combo piece. So it's not really a surprise that the commanders who are both high-value combo pieces and high-resource-generating value engines are strong choices.
And they also wind up being some of the most popular commanders you'll see away from CEDH tables, too, because they strongly inform your deck building, and they provide you rewards for following through on that deck building as well. So I guess that takes us in then, how do we take these lessons from CEDH, how do we apply them to our non-CEDH decks? I'm going to start us out here and argue that the combo-centric decks, those high-synergy decks from CEDH, still have a place at non-CEDH tables, even when you're not trying to have a zero-card combo sitting in your command zone. I would argue that the CEDH goal of those high-synergy decks is to be as efficient as possible with that win condition and as compact as possible with it. Having a way to win where half of it sits in your command zone is extremely powerful. Outside of CEDH, we don't necessarily need to try to win on the spot. So simply having a commander that has high synergy is going to make other cards that would be, again, less useful outside of this particular deck, useful again. I think a good example of this would be a card like Feather the Redeemed. This was the Boros Angel who said whenever you cast an instant or sorcery spell that targets a creature you control, exile that card instead of putting it into your graveyard as resolves. If you do, return it to your hand at the beginning of the next end step. Suddenly, all of those combat tricks and protection spells that scryed or drew you cards, those draft chaff commons and uncommons, became really cool and really powerful parts of your deck.
And cards become more optimal in decks like Tribal. So cards like Elvish Ambush, which take advantage of you already having elves, because the card simply says, create an elf token for each elf you already have on the battlefield. In most decks, that does next to nothing. And decks like Rise the Redeemed, or some of the new Lathril decks, where you want an abundance of elves on the field, this card is huge. You can have four elves that turn into eight elves, and so on and so forth. Things like that.
And then, when we're getting past the whole synergy standpoint, we want to look at value then. Not every commander needs to be Timna. Not every value commander needs to be Krum. There are a lot of potential cards that can sit in your command zone and provide value in unique ways. Jake, you had a deck that you had been brewing for a number of years now on and off that is always just kind of skirting on the edges of being done, being ready, and being in a state where you want to play it. And that would be your favorite Esper Fairy.
Yeah, I actually have, I think at this point, four different deck lists for Alayla, Artful Provocateur. I just like that she's a fairy warlock. There's not very many fairy warlocks out there. So it's an Esper deck that generates token fairies whenever you cast an artifact or enchantment spell. So for value, it doesn't necessarily have to be card draw or mana resources. It could just be anything that provides value in the game. A lot of times you can turn these tokens into mana or card draw or tutors.
And board presence is its own type of advantage, as we have described, particularly when your commander is also an anthem effect.
That is true. I do want to touch on a point that I believe it was the Mind Sculptors made in a recent episode, where they were saying you could boil down almost everything to either card draw or mana. Dumping stuff into your graveyard is basically card draw because you're just using your graveyard as your hand, or making tokens like an Alayla is essentially card draw and mana because I'm just going to sacrifice them to Culling the Weak or Phyrexian Altar to get mana or to Diabolic Intent to draw cards, that kind of stuff.
And then a little closer to home, I would say my Oops All Malcolm deck is probably, its whole goal is just to make a bunch of copies of Malcolm or Sakashima the Imposter, who is Malcolm, and clones of Sakashima, and kicked Rites of Replication on Sakashima, so that anytime any of my many copies of Malcolm hit an opponent, I'm generating oodles of treasure, and then using those to turn around and cast stupidly large blue spells that have no real purpose being cast, other than the fact I've got to do something with this Scrooge McDuckian vault.
So it's Malcolm in the middle, and on the edges, and behind you, and
above you and below you. Kiri could be considered value, which is weird, because you normally don't consider a Boros deck as a value deck, as of all things. However, with recent sets being printed and giving a bit more in terms of redundancy and value, and the ability to actually draw cards in red-white now, it does. It's actually borderline into value now. That's something. I'm having a bit of an epiphany at the moment.
And then that last category that we touched on for the CEDH decks, just a unique effect. It has kind of fallen off in CEDH, but it's still very prominent in casual decks. This could just be any commander that does something that is not necessarily a synergy or value. This, like Alex mentioned, can be a lot of tribal effects. There's certain decks that if you choose a particular commander, you're going to get a lot more tribal synergy going on. You could just like the art of a certain card. You could like some particular set mechanic, and usually there's only one or two choices for that. So if you really want to build a morph deck, your options are kind of limited, but you do have options.
You know, one could be added there for set mechanics, mutate.
Yeah, like any of these legendary creatures that feature some cool set mechanic that has come out, they don't always revisit them, so mutate, morph, foretell, any of these kind of one-off things, they'll usually, in the recent sets, print some kind of commander option, and then you can build decks around that. Recurring mechanics like cycling get a little expanded upon each time, so you might have a couple choices for that. And then again, like the CEDH option of combinations, in casual decks, there are combination commanders that can fill in multiple roles, your synergy, value, and then just unique effects that you enjoy. There's a couple examples we can touch on. For me, would probably be my Hapatra deck that I continually build and take apart, which is somewhat similar to Alayla, but it leans heavily on combos that are unique to Hapatra. It also really leverages all those snake tokens that get generated because black and green are really good at using creatures that they have out. And also, I just think it's fun.
I would argue also that Hapatra's ability to put a -1/-1 counter on opposing creatures is its own form of value. You are saving yourself a removal spell if you are using that -1/-1 counter to remove an opponent's dork.
Yeah, that's definitely true. You can remove like little obnoxious dorks. You can remove hate bears that are staxing out your main game plans, just getting rid of blockers that let you get in. It's pretty cool.
So the real question is, if the Scorpion God was Jund and included green, would you build that over Hapatra, or would you keep Hapatra because of the appeal for it?
Then I would be able to draw cards with counters, so yes.
value over appeal for Jake. Got it.
I guess the deck that I have currently that is kind of that combination, that perfect combination of all those things, I was waiting for a really long time for a proper cleric tribal deck, and my love affair with Scrap Trawler is well documented and well known. So when I saw Aura, Skyclave Hierophant, being printed, I was very happy for this. And I think, Alex, you can speak firsthand to just that synergy between the clerics and the overall grindy value nature of it. Being able to just keep recurring removal spells or just value dorks and card draw, and it gets snowbally once it gets going.
Yeah, we had it was a fun weekend of both EDH, sealed, and limited. And it was fun across multiple formats. But when it came down to playing our commander games, Aura was taking cards that are bad, for lack of better words, in every deck but Aura, and proceeded to wipe the floor with us. Slowly wiped the floor, but still did, nonetheless.
I don't think it was that slow. I think I could have sped it up maybe a little bit, but I'll get more familiar with the deck, and I will become a little bit more proficient with trying to put an end to the game once I get a hold on it. What I'm really worried about is when your Akiri deck manages to get that half a step faster than it needs, and then I'm the one who's half a step behind a giant murder core carrying a bunch of swords. And how is he carrying six swords? I don't know. Let's find out.
It's funny. That game actually channeled my inner Jake and did resolve a Godo Helm combo. Granted, Godo died before I could swing with it because, you know, clerics, but it happened. It resolved. It did a thing. And I did it before turn eight, so that was great.
Absolutely. But they're really, Alex, when I think of a deck that checks all the boxes for you, when are you rebuilding Rice the Redeemed?
Rice is my value synergy combo deck, but I think he's kind of just been overshadowed in the fact that being able to simply make oodles of tokens just isn't enough anymore. So one of the two decks I am working on is my Abzan value deck, which is going to feature heavily Ryze doing Ryze things, but he's moved from being the head of the deck to kind of being an enabler for Lathril and doing degenerate things with that.
That makes sense.
I will say this right here, though. If I could somehow convince Wizards to make a decent Sultai elf, I would be in my happy place. That'd be
well,
great.
Well, I mean, they did make one.
It has to be decent.
I guess he is pretty indecent.
There's a reason that we will not speak his name.
No, it's good that Leovold is banned. I would not like to play in a Leovold-dominated meta, because the best way to fight a Leovold deck is with a Leovold deck.
We shall not speak his name.
Okay, so the pipe dream is this, and the reason I say Sultai is exclusively for Intruder Alarm.
Okay, got it. That's all you needed to say there, Intruder Alarm. Well, that is kind of our summary of what it takes to build a commander. We've seen what it takes in the CDH metagame, where you really do need to have some powerful A plus B combo, where half of it is sitting in your command zone, or you need to have a very powerful source of value. But once you apply those sources of value to what is possible outside of CDH, there are a lot of options that you can go for. But I think understanding what the appeal of the card is and that particular commander is, and then understanding where it's able to either get you that value or have those strong synergy effects, that will help direct how you're going to build the deck in really interesting and unique ways. Jake, Alex, do you guys have any other closing thoughts on what makes a good commander before we start closing this episode out?
I think it's just important when you are choosing a commander for a deck to try to see if you can make it check off some of these boxes, see if you can get a potential synergy or combo piece, see if it's a value engine, maybe both. And if there's just something unique that speaks to you from that particular commander, and the more boxes you can check with one, the better your deck could be.
That's a good capstone on this discussion. With our discussion done, you guys know what it's time for, right?
The hot
pizza
seat.
Oh, shoot.
Hot Pockets? It's a mix of both, the hot seat and pizza.
Ugh.
So, we talked about Time Spiral Remastered during our news section, bringing back the original frames from 1993 for quite a few cards on that time-shifted screen. Not unlike showcase frames have been used in sets recently. What are the frame treatments that we have seen throughout Magic's history that you would like to see come back as a nostalgia frame? And what kind of set do you think it would be appropriate for?
I'm trying to think of the exact name for it. It is whatever that weird experimental frame was they used on Tarmogoyf.
That would be the future shifted frame.
The future shifted frame. I like those.
What kind of a set would be good for that one?
So, it would be anything that would, if we're talking from like a Magic standpoint, it'd be anything that involves Teferi as one of like the primary story players in that set, because it could be things that he's seeing from a temporal standpoint in the future, and those cards could be future sight cards with those frames. That would
all right.
Be.
All right. I can see that. I definitely had the future shifted frames as one of the ones in mind when I was coming up with this question.
I would say, I just want to point out, it is neat. It's not saying it's good. It is just neat.
I do like the future shifted frames because of the placement for the mana cost, how they chose to put it on the left vertical edge because that's where you would see it as you fan your cards out.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it was kind of neat that they addressed some of the actual gameplay in the card design to try to make it accommodate how you play the game.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you on that one. What about you, Jake? What do you think would be a cool frame treatment to bring back?
I am looking at frames of the past to try to figure the answer out for this one, so you might want to...
It's too early to say Kaldheim, right?
It is too early to say Kaldheim. I think it's not nostalgic enough yet. If you want to learn more about the history of frames, Sam over at Ristic Studies has done a really cool video detailing the entire history up through, I think it was like a year or two ago when he did the video, of all of the different frame treatments we have seen throughout Magic.
I remember watching that, so I may have to go watch that again.
It's worth asking, will these frames come back in their original concept, or will they just be like foil, non-foil versions? Because I think for Jake, I'll suggest an idea that the Masterpiece frames are really nice, but I know how you feel about foils. So,
yeah, some of the Masterpiece frames I did enjoy. I do like the Zendikar Masterpiece frame.
Those would be the Expedition
on the lands.
Frames.
Yes,
yeah.
Those. I thought those looked kind of cool. What would you pick, John?
I also like those Expedition frames, but I think the one that I would be really excited to see come back as a showcase type of thing would be the pirate map look they did for the Ixalan Fliplands. The cards that are a permanent or something on one side and then flip into a land on the other side. I think Itlamok, Cradle of the Sun, is probably the most prolific one of these cards. That is just such a cool-looking frame. It really kind of captured the pirate adventure exploration narrative of Ixalan really well. And there are a lot of adventure exploration themes explored in a lot of Magic sets. And I just like that one. I'd like to see it revisited in different color treatments as well. And that could be really cool.
So Zendikar Rising might have missed out on that. That is what you're saying. Because exploration is the name of the plan.
Yeah, but I like that the travel guide Hedron look to it as well, but I really liked the Ixalan one.
Yeah, so, those do look pretty cool. And this might be cheating. It's like the color shifted planes. What was it? Plane shift?
It was not plane shift. It was planar chaos.
Planar chaos, yes. I guess they called them. Yeah, the color shifted ones like Damnation and Harmonize. I do like that frame. So it's the modern frame, which I do think looks cool, but they use the white text on the title and card type. I don't know. I think those look pretty cool. And whenever I can, I usually pick up that version of those cards.
That's a good call.
So touching on that then, since we're talking about frames and all as the hot seat, frames versus full art.
¿Por qué no los dos?
That's fair. I enjoy both equally.
I usually go for the versions with text, just for clarity purposes.
Oh God, have you ever actually seen the
cryptic command?
Cryptic command.
Like, that's just ridiculous. Why would they?
Gave a talk at a judge conference, and one of the examples I used was a case where a player was using textless cryptic commands, the player rewards one. I'm going to post a picture of this in the video. It is the most ridiculous use of that textless frame ever.
But it looks
and
good.
Literally every judge looked like their soul had just been ripped out through their faces.
I would be hard-pressed to come up with a card that is less suited for a textless promo format than Cryptic Command.
Anything with banding.
Like
Chains of Mephistopheles.
I don't know. At this point, like the card text on Chains is just ridiculous, so you just Oracle reference it anyway.
All right. I concede the point. I think that's a good place for us to leave it. If you guys have any questions or comments, or if you have any other categorizations you think we should be looking at when we're talking about what makes a good commander, be sure to add us on Twitter, where we are GemstoneMindMTG. You can send us an email on Gmail at GemstoneMindPodcast@gmail.com, or leave us a comment on YouTube, where we are GemstoneMind. Until next time, I'm John.
I'm Alex.
And I'm Jake.
You can reach the crew from Gemstone Mine on Twitter at GemstoneMineMTG or send us an email at GemstoneMinePodcast@gmail.com. On YouTube, we're Gemstone Mine Podcast. Be sure to like, subscribe, and hit the notification bell.